Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Sujit DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is being recorded on Wednesday, January 13th of 2021, our first 2021 recorded episode. Today is episode number 361, and we've got our special guest is Ben Cutler, and he's going to be talking about Project Natick. Before we get to that, let's go ahead and talk about some news. So, Kale, I think you said you put something in?
Yeah. I think the others have some too, but I'll go ahead. I got three quick ones here. Actually, the first one, I'm surprised, Evan, you're not on this.
Oh, I should have taken that.
No, it's kind of a high-level one, but it's a good one. Azure SQL Database named one of the top three databases of 2020. And this is in terms of kind of popularity of DBMS and different, you know, kind of popularity scores that these guys kind of put together. End result is, you know, Azure SQL is a very flexible database, as probably most of our listeners know, but there's many different ways to kind of configure it that have grown over the years that Evan lives and breathes. And
I remember the pain.
Yeah. So it's kind of some high-level links there to the Azure SQL stuff, maybe for some of the listeners who aren't as familiar with all the offerings, but pretty nice accolade there how popular, you know, that database platform has been.
Yeah, no, that's cool.
Real quick, two other ones, and these are a little bit more developer-focused. So one of them about, I think this has been announced a while back, but at DockerCon, there was an announcement about some tighter integration with Microsoft with the Docker tools. And specifically, this post is about the Azure Container Instances that we have available inside of Azure. So there's some specific integration built into the Docker command line tools, like the CLI tools, as well as the Docker Desktop, to work with your Azure subscription and also, you know, specifically the ACI. So what that means is, like, directly from the Docker CLI, you can actually provision into ACI in this case, which is pretty slick.
Cool.
And last one for devs is, I think the title of this was like jumpstart your developer skills with these coding packs, which kind of intrigued me. I didn't know what these coding packs were all about, but essentially what it is using VS Code and specific runtimes. I think in this one, they're talking about Python and Java. This kind of helps people who maybe are getting started, or maybe they already did know stuff about those languages. But this is like getting you started with how you can be productive with VS Code. And then there's some specific like coding packs, which are basically these single downloads that has, you know, different kind of exercises to go through there, essentially to like show you how you could be like really fast developing with these products and then learning obviously more about Python and Java. So I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
Awesome. I can follow up on some of these. So just a couple of AKS related updates. ACR is now supported across availability zones. That's in preview. So just keep that in mind. I know that availability zones already available in AKS, but now you can kind of use that same paradigm for ACR. And then also Azure Monitor for Containers now works with private clusters, or at least that's in preview. So I just wanted to call those out quickly. Also, I know I've mentioned this on previous shows, but we do have an AKS public office hours that my team has been running. So we're kicking off the new year with one on January 14th. They're at 11 o'clock CST, and you can find all the information about those and more Azure Kubernetes service specific updates, since I won't take up all of our time on the podcast with these, at aka.ms/AKS public office hours. So if you like these updates that I give on here, you'll definitely like that call a lot. So
cool. Hey, Kendall,
real quick on that, because I know we got some feedback from listeners. ACR, what is that?
Oh, Azure Container Registry. Good call. So Azure Container Registry, where you store your images that you'll then, you know, securely deploy into your AKS cluster or, you know, clusters hosted elsewhere. Thanks for the call out.
Cool. Okay. Well,
and so I actually have one more.
Sorry, Cynthia.
No worries. There is a new capability that is in public preview, which is cross-resource query between Azure Monitor and Azure Data Explorer. So what that means is now that you're able to query across Azure Data Explorer and Azure Monitor within your log analytics or application insights.
Oh,
the other benefit cool. out of it is that you can actually now export your Azure Monitor logs into a storage account, which will make it a lot cheaper for retention purposes. And then you can still query that using Azure Data Explorer. So a lot of explorers and monitors, but now you get all your insights.
So you kind of get it all in one place at that point, or at least from a materialized, it shows up as if it was in one place, even though it's spread around. That's cool. Excellent. Okay, well, cool. So at this point, Ben, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us what you do for Microsoft?
Sure. Good morning. So I'm Ben Cutler. I'm in a group called Special Projects in Microsoft Research. And we are a group that looks around the company for what we see as big material challenges for the company. And then we run projects that are focused specifically on that. And these are not projects that last forever. We run them for one or two iterations, and we either decide that was a really bad idea and we kind of move on, or we try and take the learnings from that and transition it to one of the product groups. And so one of the things that I lead is Project Natick, which is Microsoft's underwater data center effort.
Cool. Yeah. So whatever possessed us to want to put a data center in the water?
there are many answers to that question. So one answer to that is there's a gentleman named Sean James who works in the data center design team. And in an earlier part of his life, worked on ballistic missile submarines in the United States Navy. And so he knew something about water and cooling and thought something would be interesting. So he co-authored a ThinkWeek paper back when we did those a few years ago. And that got our attention when we were looking at things to do. And so we looked at that and, of course, immediately said, well, that's just ridiculous. But then being, good scientists and engineers, we looked at it and thought about, okay, well, how would we actually apply this and what benefits would we actually get? And at that time, one of the things that was going on in the world, this is back in 2014 or thereabouts, was the Edward Snowden thing, where suddenly lots of countries were wanting their data local. And so one of the ways to do that is you have to respond quickly, potentially, to do that. And so the first thing we looked at was rapid deployment. And so our initial mantra for this was deployment at scale anywhere in the world within 90 days from decision to power up. And so that was kind of how this got started, and advantages in being able to do this offshore more rapidly than we can do these things on land, just because on land, we got to build a building, takes a long time, there's a whole process there. This is more like, if you will, the cell phone in your pocket. Manufacture them in a factory, they're ready to go, complete with servers, and very rapidly position them and get them started.
What happens when something is broken underwater? Does someone go in and fix it, or do they have to take the whole thing out?
You'd have to take the whole thing out. And so the model here is what we call fail in place, or sometimes we say graceful degradation. And the idea is that unlike a typical data center today, as things fail, we don't fix it. We expect that we're going to lose some percentage of our equipment over the deployment, and the data center continues to operate in a way that's transparent to the software. And software here means our customers, not Azure. Azure still has to understand what's going on and accommodate that. I mean, truth is today, right, things fail all the time in data centers and Azure accommodates that. It's just after a few hours, someone comes in and it's back the way it was before. This is actually really important because as we look toward a future with more and more edge data centers, we're not going to have somebody there to fix things right away when they break. And so this learning of how do you operate remotely, in our case, 2 years we operated, 864 servers, no one touching anything. And to do that reliably, our learnings we're now bringing back to the land and applying to our larger land-based data centers to increase reliability, improve costs, and then actually give us that greater facility as edge data centers become more and more prevalent as we go forward.
So yeah, Ben, I have a couple of questions for you. So just to level set for
I'll go ahead and throw them both out at you and you can answer them at your will. But in terms of where we are now, you know, what is the stage in which this like research is in, right? Are these actively already in place? Do we have customer data that's deployed in these underwater data centers, or is that kind of earlier incubation phase? And then from a customer perspective, you know, is this going to show up as like East US 2 underground or like underwater? How does, you know, it's like, do I actually choose to deploy it here? Will it just look like an edge site? Will it, like, I'm just kind of curious, you know, as a consumer, what this would be surfaced up.
Still want like that in the portal, Kendall, like that.
Yeah, I know. It's so like underwater zone 8, you know?
SpongeBob icon, you know?
Yeah. So for this one that we put in the water, there was no customer data on it. It's a research article. We did have 18 groups inside Microsoft that used it actually for their daily work. So it was a real operating data center getting used to do actual work, but not something that was accessible to outside customers, just because there's a lot of complexity in that and making sure that we're keeping that data safe and secure. And we, as researchers, wanted a little more flexibility in what we did. One of the ways, by the way, that we leveraged that is when COVID came around, there's this thing called folding at home, which is where people can like download software. And like when their computer's idle, it's doing scientific research. So when COVID came around, people started doing protein folding related to COVID. And so at that time, we actually took the entire data center and pushed it over to exactly that. And so we were actually one of the, in the top 1% of contributors to this project going through the first half of 2020. So this data center did a lot of stuff for internal product groups doing things and then contributed to a COVID response. So, you know, would it show as a region or what would it be? We've had a lot of discussions about that. And as I think you know, Azure now has a tooling that allows customers to understand the benefits they're getting in terms of their power consumption from using Azure versus non-green sort of standard data centers. And so we've had discussions related to this as well, that we could imagine there might be customers that would want to be in this much greener environment. And it's greener in a whole variety of ways. So, you know, early on when we were doing this, we sent out solicitations to potential partners, and really the first and foremost thing there was greenness or sustainability. And so some of our requirements were that the whole thing would be completely recyclable. So, for example, the data center that was in Scotland has now been, you know, carved up and all the metals recycled, the seabed restored to its original state. So that was part and parcel. We use a lot less electricity being in the water because it's a much more efficient medium for cooling than on land. And then also another thing about this is, so we use seawater for cooling, right? So we're just sort of flowing that seawater past and that sort of cools the thing down. Many people don't know this, but modern building architecture uses a lot of water for cooling, and that includes data centers. And so that's a challenge because many places in the world, that's an important resource. And so this is a model that allows us to not use any water for cooling whatsoever. So we can take this anywhere in the world, use offshore renewable energy, do our own cooling, and really not impose on, you know, local society in a way that when we, you know, build big things today, we have to worry about. Do as the corporation have these big commitments around waste and water and electricity. And so, you know, a few years back when we started this, those things were all like center of mind for us. And so a lot, even though this is a very strange data center in a lot of ways, some of the things that we're learning here, for example, I mentioned the fail in place, but also on the sustainability side is just sort of learning some of them we can take back to land. So one of the things, of course, is that renewable energy is a lot more difficult to manage than conventional energy. You know, when I have an old traditional coal power plant or something like that, I kind of pretty much know how much power it's going to produce. When I've got solar cells or I've got wind, that's much more variable. And so we actually in special projects have work going on in AI to understand that and predict that and help balance kind of how grid behaves. And so there's a lot of learnings that even though it's this very strange environment, come back to our more conventional data centers. One of the things about this is that it's a sealed thing, right? So there's no people there. And so we can kind of do whatever we want with the atmosphere. And so one of the things we did is there's no oxygen. So it's a nitrogen atmosphere. And so that means that one of the problems, of course, that we have in data centers is there's moisture. And moisture causes corrosion, you know, rust if it's iron and, you know, other types of things with different metals. And that can cause failed connections in servers. And, you know, it can happen to your PC too, but you have, you know, maybe like 10 connections in there. In a data center, there's hundreds of thousands. This is a real thing that we see all the time. And so we saw 1/8 the failure rate in this data center, we think in large part because we didn't have corrosion going on there. So we're actually working now with The Surface product team actually has a forensic group that analyzes electronics. And now their day job is like when a new Surface Book comes back and it doesn't work, or Xbox goes out and some of the new units don't work, they want to understand that so they can improve the quality. But we're working with that team now to understand the experience we had from this data center relative to a control group of the identical servers we had in another LAN data center to understand the differences of those two experiences, and then try and see what learnings we can take back to, from that again to our LAN data centers.
Yeah, kind of on the opposite approach, like talking about the cooling a little bit, is it so deep in the ocean that like the heat that's being transferred from the data center in this case out to the ocean, like what kind of impact is that having on the fish? Are they like, what's going on? It's like warm down here now, like, you know.
I guess there's a couple answers to that. One of which is, if you go and look, you know, at some of our videos and stuff, you can see the fish swarming around there. And when you put these things, anything in the ocean like this, it becomes sort of this artificial reef. And things tend to go around it. So when we first put it in the water, honestly, like the first night we were like watching on the cameras, it was just disgusting. There are these like strange like worm things, you know, swimming around. And so that's what you start with. And then you gradually get things start to grow on the surface of the thing. And then you get the things that eat them and then the things that eat them. And so after a few weeks, you have like these massive schools of fish all over the place. We had octopi. We had one day we had a seal come by. We got a seal on video. And so it tends to be something that wildlife likes. Now, this question of temperature is a real issue. Water has this enormous heat capacity, right? And we know this because, for example, you know, you're trying to heat your pot of water to heat your tea or your coffee, and it takes forever for the darn thing to go, even though there's this big thing going on. And that's because water has this huge heat capacity. But it's not infinite, obviously. And so we're very conscious of that. And so one of the things is that if you look at all the oceans in the world and you put all of today's data centers in the oceans and, you know, all the heat goes there, the oceans overall would rise a few billionths of a degree per year from those data centers. It's really kind of tiny. But what we worry about is stagnant water, right? So if you put it in a swimming pool, that pool is going to get hotter. So one of the things that's nice about the ocean is there's always these currents moving, so we're never accumulating heat in one place. So that's something that we look at, and it's why we'd not like stick it in your local pond or something, because it would have some environmental impact, and we don't want that. So that's something that we pay very close attention to. And I think it's also worth noting that if you look at the data, the amount of energy that comes from the sun is a huge, huge multiple compared to all the energy we produce and consume on Earth. If you look at all of the renewable energy, all the conventional energy, solar, hydro, all this stuff, it's just, you know, a few percent of the amount of energy that hits the Earth from the sun. The issue is the carbon in the atmosphere basically creates this barrier so that the heat from that sun that normally reflects back to space, it's harder for it to do that. So it's not that like we produce or use too much energy here, it's just that the carbon impedes the ability that to just sort of, you know, easily go back to space. I think also some people wonder, well, so is this a problem for the oceans that you're kind of putting in the water? It's really modest effect, as I stated. But the other thing to understand is that if you look at the data, 90% of all of the impact of global warming over the last 50 years has gone into the oceans, right? It's a combined system, you know, and we know this because like, depending on the temperature, you can see like the mist over a pond, or, you know, the winter, you know, the pond freezes because of the impact of the air. And so there's this illusion that, you know, these are separate systems, but it's all combined. And so really the big issue here is addressing carbon. And so, you know, that's the global issue. The local issue for sure is we don't want to be in a pond. So we're always in some active area. And actually, in the case of Scotland, it was kind of crazy active. We're in a test site for renewable energy devices. And so where we were get waves of up to 10 meters in the winter. And so 10 meters means if I'm normally at about 33 meters depth, which is what we are, it really ranges from 23 to 43 during a storm, which is just sort of, you know, this crazy variant. So we went there because we knew it was this crazy place. And so it would be a good place to sort of test this so that if it works here, we know we can kind of take this anywhere.
And just to follow up on that, like how the connectivity, So you mentioned like putting it out there where things are active and things like that. And obviously maybe in this case, it's like a very controlled environment or semi-controlled, but like, is there just like a massive chunk of cables running down to this thing? And how do you like, do you just like keep it close to land so the ship doesn't run into it or something else gets like tangled in those wires, you know, kind of thing?
Yeah. So, so you look out at the ocean and it looks like this, you know, empty space. But it's really not. And if you look at any area around population, there's maps, you know, where here's where these cables go and, you know, shipping's allowed here and fisher, you know, fishing ships can go here and there may be some restricted government thing here. And so you're actually in this fairly regulated and controlled space, even though it doesn't look like that from the surface. And so there is an issue of, you know, where you go, right? So if we're like in the middle of the ocean, yeah, you're kind of international water and like pirates are going to come and get you or something. And so, you know, as we've always thought about this, we've thought about it as something that we're within the territorial waters of some country, right? So that the normal laws apply to us, right? So we're not kind of doing anything that we shouldn't. And by the same token, we have the protections of being within that regulatory domain of some country so that we don't have to worry that some pirate's going to come and, you know, try and take our thing. And there are things that you do to worry about, for example, anchors, right? So one of the dangers is, you know, a fishing boat or something puts down its anchor and forgets to pick it up and starts tooling away and they're dragging it along the ground. But so there's things that you do to protect these things to make them resilient against that sort of thing. And the truth is that these things, if we ever did these, you know, at some reasonable scale, are a lot bigger in mass than a fishing boat. And so, you know, we would be fine. You know, we're like coming from this world of data centers and computers and software. But long before there were computers, there were people like working in the ocean, including doing subsea cables. And so there's a lot of knowledge there. It's a very mature industry. And so all the questions and things that we worry about, people have dealt with for a very long time already.
So from what you just said, they're like hanging in the water and they're not necessarily at the bottom of the ocean?
The data center?
Yes, the data center.
No, the data center as we do it is sitting on the bottom.
We did
early on talk about the idea of one that would be sort of, you know, up in the water, sort of in the stream. The theory was, well, like maybe we'll get better cooling that way. And, you know, the physics says that's not really true. And also it becomes as enormously complicated physics problem to have this thing suspended in the water. Because it's not just hanging there, it's actually like tethered, like it's going to be held there mm-hmm. by cables. And so you get into all these strange issues with the current and moving in different directions and inducing vibrations in the cables and rotations. And, you know, if you think about like the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapse, you know, so all those sorts of physics problems apply here. And it was just like, yeah, we're not going to, we're not going there. So as we think about this, we think of things that are somewhere between tens of meters up to maybe 300 meters deep and no more than that. And that keeps us, you know, within 12 nautical miles or so of shore and, you know, just fine cooling pretty much anywhere, including tropical areas.
So, Ben, on this, is there a current path forward or a roadmap? Like, is this something that's still just being iterated on, learnings are being digested, or is there like a clear path forward that Microsoft has kind of taken, like, oh, we're going to do X number of underwater data centers in before 2030 or whatever that might look like? Just kind of curious.
So I'm research, so I don't get to make those decisions.
Okay, interesting.
That's the first thing. So we've done two of these things. So we did one off the California, which like a small thing that was like one rack, one 42U rack, and it was that was just sort of, okay, this is crazy. Let's put it in the water and see if, you know, we can power them this way. We can keep them dry. And that was just off the side of a pier. And then we've done the second one, which was demonstration at scale. So it's 12 racks, 864 blades. It's in 33 meters of water. It's a kilometer offshore in open ocean. And so, you know, a real operating environment. And we did that for 2 years. And so I think at this point, the science questions are resolved. And it's just a question of whether it makes business sense and whether we want to go down this path. That's the basic question of, like, do we do these more in the water? We have a lot of discussions, you know, with various parties that have interest in this, both in the power industry as well as consumers of energy for various reasons. And then again, I think a lot of what we've done here is just sort of learnings here that we also want to bring back to our fleet of land data centers in terms of greater resilience, you know, greater reliability and longevity, and then as we think out toward edge. And I think one of the things that is worth thinking about here is, you know, there's this notion of the end of Moore's law. And so, you know, do we get to a point where we don't replace servers every 2 or 3 years? We've gradually been keeping them longer and longer. And so then this whole question of reliability and resilience becomes much more important than today, or more often than not, we may replace a server just because, hey, there's a better one out there and our customers want it. So there's a lot of different factors here. And so our job is really just sort of to do the research and help inform decisions that as a company we choose to make.
Yeah, this is cool, Ben. I'm just, you know, I'm a chemical engineer by education. I'm just thinking, this would have been like my thermo final would be to calculate the heat transfer rate for this, you know, cylinder of this size and this length sitting at this depth in the ocean. This is great. We're definitely going to have to get, you know, some links from you in terms of some of the white papers you said that are published, because I'm sure the audience will be super interested. I remembered his name. Connor Kelly was on the show a couple weeks back to talk about the solar system. This just really fits into the green work and the sustainability work that we were doing. And I'm going to ask you a personal favor here. So I work on the broken side of our business. Before I retire, I want to be able to tell a customer that I'm sorry your server rebooted because, you know, a fish chewed the line or a pirate stole the server. I just want to be able to say that. That's, you know.
There's a lot of work that's going into these cables. And I don't know if people know, but like these cables that go in the water are what they call armored cables. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, think about like your power cord or your, you know, your fiber line or whatever. And then it's wrapped literally in a layer of these steel rods. And depending on where it's going, it could be 2 or 3 layers of those. So you got to work really hard to damage one of these cables.
Now I got to blame it on the software. Sorry.
Sorry, I'm a software person too. And yes, we always get the blame in the end. It's true.
Cool. No, this is great, Ben. Any last thoughts you want to leave the audience with?
I think that, we're very interested in sort of figuring out how to sort of move the ball forward in terms of cloud and what we can do to sort of help. And, you know, there's just all these different ways that things are happening. And so Project Natick is one example of the things that we're doing there. But there's a bunch of other things that we're working on that relate to, you know, cybersecurity, big data analytics, helping keep customers safe, defending democracy. These are just some of the other things that we're doing in special projects. And, you know, in all of these cases, really, it's founded on Azure and using that or helping improve that system.
Yeah, great. Yeah, no, it all feeds into each other in the end, which is awesome. Cool. Well, we will, I'll follow up with you offline and we'll get some of these links. And, if you think anything else you want to put on the show notes, and we'll get it out to the audience.
All right. Hey, thanks for your time today.
Great. Thanks, folks. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us. Thank you.